From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, dealing with anger and disagreements in relationships, we talk with John Gottman, director of the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. His theories are based on his work observing couples and videotaping their interactions. And with only 20 more shopping days until Christmas, retail anthropologist Paco Underhill talks about the science of shopping. He knows the mysterious ways of shoppers and how retailers take advantage of consumers' quirks. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews pianist Horace Silver's CD, A Prescription for the Blues. And film critic John Powers reviews Good Will Hunting, starring Robin Williams and Matt Damon. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The nation's unemployment rate in November fell to its lowest level in nearly 25 years. This as the economy added 404,000 new jobs. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The strength in job creation surprised analysts who have detected signs of slowing in the economy. They had expected about half as many workers to be added to payrolls. The unemployment rate fell to 4.6%, down 0.1% from October. That jobless rate was last achieved in October of 1973. In the service industries, employment increased by 332,000. 44,000 jobs were added in manufacturing. The tight labor market helped produce a solid wage increase. The average hourly wage rose 7 cents. Taken alone, the strong employment report might have prompted the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. However, analysts think the Fed will hold off for now until the effects of the Asian economic turmoil on the United States become clearer. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
Iraq says it won't export any oil under the United Nations Oil for Food arrangement until a new plan to distribute food is adopted. The Oil for Food program is now in its third phase. It was renewed yesterday by the UN Security Council. Iraq says that earlier, the United States held up scores of contracts to buy goods. The United States says it blocked goods like tires and helicopter parts because these could be used by the Iraqi military. But UN officials say these supplies are also necessary for crop dusting and medical deliveries. Russia's Federal Security Service today formally charged an American telephone engineer with espionage. Richard Bliss has been held for 10 days in southern Russia. From Moscow, NPR's Eric Engelman reports.
Russia's Federal Security Service confirmed that 29-year-old Richard Bliss has been formally charged with espionage. Bliss, a phone technician, was arrested 10 days ago in the southern Russian city of Rostov-on-Don after performing land surveys for a San Diego-based telecommunications company. The firm has a contract to build mobile phone systems in the area. The security agents who arrested Bliss claimed he was using satellite dishes to collect secret information on closed sites. They say they have evidence of concrete deeds to back up their accusations, but cannot make the charges public because of security concerns. The U.S. Embassy in Moscow denies Bliss is a spy and says he has no connection to the U.S. government. Bliss does not speak Russian, and this was his first visit to the country. For NPR News, I'm Eric Engelman in Moscow.
Hundreds of people are attending the funeral of former Detroit Mayor Coleman Young. Aretha Franklin is singing at the service. Young, who served 5 terms in office as Detroit's first black mayor, lay in state at the city's Museum of African American History for 2 days. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 80 points at 8,130. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has recovered from its initial shock of the surprisingly strong report on November unemployment. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The strength of the jobs data is being overshadowed by the view that the Asian financial crisis will keep the Federal Reserve from raising interest rates this month. A Fed official told Bloomberg that policymakers expect the fallout from the Asian crisis to slow U.S. economic growth to around a 2.25% to a 2.5% annual rate. The most active issue is Ascend Communications, which has gained more than 10%. The computer network maker is expecting fourth quarter earnings to meet expectations. There is also strength among international oil and computer system stocks. I'm Doug Krisner.
Federal regulators have told the nation's largest railroad to keep cooperating with competitors to clear up rail gridlock in western states. Railroad Union Pacific had argued against that three-month extension of a government emergency order. It says things will be unclogged shortly. The nation's largest brokerage firm could be getting bigger. The Wall Street Journal reports Merrill Lynch is far along in talks to acquire the technology investment bank Hambrecht and Quist for more than $1 billion. Big demand for planes, cars, paper, and food products meant the fifth straight increase in orders to the nation's factories last month. Orders rose 0.3% in November. That's not considered a major gain, but it was more than economists were expecting. And the government's latest challenge to Microsoft is bringing both sides before a federal judge today. He may hear arguments and give decisions or put things off to a later date. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Why do some marriages work and others fail? That's the question that occupies the mind of John Gottman. Gottman directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute and is a professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He also runs weekend workshops for couples, which he calls the Marriage Survival Kit. His books include Why Marriages Fail and Succeed and The Heart of Parenting, Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child. Terry spoke with John Gottman earlier this year.
It doesn't sound very romantic when couples discuss having to work on their relationships. But let's face it, a lot of couples need to work on how they handle conflict. That's where my guest, Dr. John Gottman, comes in. He spent the past 25 years observing how couples interact and analyzing why some relationships last and others fall apart. I asked Dr. Gottman what he's looking for when he observes how couples interact.
Well, actually, the only thing I really bring to the whole question is just one thing. And that, if I can tell you a story, when I was a beginning assistant professor, I was interested in the problem of kids who didn't have any friends. And I found that there was a psychologist who had developed a program to help kids make friends. And I called him up and I asked him for information about the program and would he send me the materials he had developed. And then I asked him, how did you develop these materials? And he said, well, I sat around with a couple of graduate students and we tried to imagine what it was like to be 4 years old and we figured out how to make friends. And I did some research after that, which took me about 10 years to find out how children really do make friends. Turned out that he was teaching children to do things like go over to other kids and say, hi, my name is Harold, can I play with you? And that turned out in the research I did later to be the perfect way to get rejected.
Yeah.
So, you know, what the only thing I bring to this whole thing is really trying to find out what it is that real couples do whose, you know, marriages are going well, or, you know, marriages are stable and satisfying, rather than trying to assume that I know. We do things like, you know, in Seattle we have 130 newlyweds we've been following for the past 8 years. And we also study couples who've been married a long time, two groups of couples in their 40s and one group of couple in their 60s, and try to see, you know, just what do these people actually do to make their marriages work.
Now, how do you study this?
A variety of ways. We really try to do it just about every way we can. I have an apartment laboratory in Seattle where couples live for 24 hours, and they don't have any instructions. They just come there in the morning with a bag of groceries, and they read the Sunday paper, and they eat together and watch television and work, do what they normally would do at home. We also have them
But you're running surveillance on them while they do this, right?
Right, there's four cameras pointed at them. Yeah. They wear these Holter monitors that measure electrocardiograms. And every time they urinate, we take a sample of the urine and get stress hormones out of the assays and take blood from them at the end and look at their immune system. But after about 45 minutes, people are really kind of behaving naturally. We actually know that they never totally behave naturally. They're a little nicer to each other when their camera is there than they would be at home. We've actually recorded them at home, and there's a lot more upset and nastiness that goes on for longer periods of time when they're home.
So if somebody says, dear, you know, I really hate it when you leave the dishes for me to do, then you're measuring the stress hormones, the blood pressure, heartbeat in
exactly
both of the members of the couple when this,
yeah,
conversation continues.
That's right. That's right. And then we show them their videotapes and ask them to tell us what were you thinking? What were you feeling? What do you think your partner was thinking and feeling? We interview them about these moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then we record their facial muscles and code exactly what emotional expressions are on their face, what's going on in the voice, what's going on in the body, what they're saying. So we actually have observers there coding people's behavior, categorizing every small behavior that they engage in. And then we interview them about the history of their relationship, how they met, how they think about their marriage, and various difficult times and how they get through difficult times. Try to get their philosophy and their own narratives about their marriage, very much like Studs Terkel would do.
Mm-hmm.
When he sits with somebody in their attic and asks them, tell me about this doll. In fact, we model a lot of our interviewing on Studs Terkel's methods.
When you're doing one of these marital interviews, does each member of the couple contradict the other in describing the marital history?
Happens sometimes,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Most of the time, they kind of complete each other's sentences, and they present really sort of a united front. But a lot of times, you'll find one person says, "Well, this is a very difficult period for us," and the other person says, "Well, for you, it was a difficult period. For me, it was a great period." And so that person is really saying, "We're not really a unit; we're very different from each other." So it does happen a lot.
Do the couples watch the videotapes that you make of them?
Yes, they do. And we asked them to sort of narrate those videotapes and tell us what was going on in their minds. What were they thinking about? What were they feeling during those tapes? And we try to find out sort of what's different about what the observers see and what they perceive.
And what is often different?
Well, there's a very interesting phenomenon that happens in some marriages. Some of the time, the observers will say, well, this comment was really quite neutral. It wasn't even emotional, and yet the spouse will perceive it as very provocative. For example, a wife might say something like, you really aren't supposed to run the microwave oven with no food in it. And yet the partner will say, don't tell me what to do. Did you read the manual? You never read manuals. That's your problem. And some of the times, that wife might say something like, what's the matter with you? You're not supposed to run the microwave with no food in it. And the husband will say, oh, yeah, okay, thanks. I didn't know that. So you have this discrepancy between the way observers see it and the way the partners see it. That turns out to be a very critical dimension, because if you have a positive perspective, you see these sort of irritable kind of statements. You take the irritability as if the statement were in italics. You say, this must be important to my partner. If you've got that positive perspective, it turns out to predict an ability to repair conflict when it doesn't go well. And if you don't have that positive perspective, if you have more of a negative perspective, it predicts, in fact, that your ability to resolve conflict will deteriorate over time.
Hmm. So people get deeper and deeper into those patterns?
Exactly, exactly.
When somebody sees this on the videotape, or when you point it out to them, how easy is it to repair?
It really isn't easy to change the positive or negative perspective. You have to do a whole bunch of things that really underlie these. And that's one of the things that we've discovered in the past couple of years, is that, there's been a focus, very strong focus, on the resolution of conflict as being the way that couples really can get close and make their marriages work. And we've discovered that really that's wrong. That in fact, the everyday interaction that couples have with one another, and there really are three things that form the basis of this positive perspective that makes them able to solve problems. One of them is just kind of knowing one another, knowing things about one another. And it really has to do with, we actually have a board game that couples play in our workshops, where we ask them things like, who is your spouse's least favorite relative? Or what side of the bed does your spouse prefer to sleep on? And a lot of people don't know things like that.
So what you're saying there is one of the really most important aspects of a successful relationship is paying attention to the person you're in the relationship with.
Exactly, and knowing things about them. So if you opened up the skull of some guys, you'd find a lot of brain cells allocated to the relationship and the partner. And other guys, you'd find, very few. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see this. So when we ask people how they met, some guys are saying things like, oh, you know, it was, I remember the night we met at this dance and, you know, she was wearing a yellow dress and the band was playing As Time Goes By. And I thought it was just a slow song. I could ask her to dance. And, but then I found my feet were glued to the floor. My heart was beating fast. And then she came over, asked me to dance. And you ask another guy, how did you and your wife meet? And he'll say, Anna, how did we meet? Really, you know, it's right. Very, very clear differences between people. So that's the first step out of three for building this positive perspective.
What's the next one?
Well, the next one is really the fondness and admiration system. It's really how much affection there is and how much respect there is in this relationship. And some people really, you know, spontaneously say things like, boy, you know, there's one thing really I really admire about Jane. You know, she's really got a lot of guts. I mean, she had this boss who was really domineering, and Jane just went in and told her what she thought, and boy, I would never do that. And, you know, and she's done this with our son too, and she's gone and, you know, confronted the teacher who was really giving him a hard time. And you know, some guys never say things like that. And we find that this fondness and admiration system is really critical in keeping romance going in the relationship.
And the third
is what I call the emotional bank account. It really doesn't have much to do with emotional events. It's these everyday sort of mundane events that happen between people who are in a close relationship. And, you know, it can be something like one person's brushing their teeth in the morning and is in a big hurry. And then the partner comes in and says, I just had a disturbing dream. And then that, you know, you can either turn toward your partner and say something like, I'm in a real big hurry, but what'd you dream? And then you get a sort of a rundown of the dream, and then later on you think about it, and then you talk about it at dinner. Or you can just say, well, you know, I'm in a big hurry. I really can't talk about this. It's not that turning away is necessarily hostile. It's just that over time, there's a characteristic either of turning toward or turning away. So couples who are heading for divorce, you know, 60 to 80% of the time, they're turning away from one another. And couples whose marriages are going very well, 60 to 80% of the time, they're turning toward one another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Gottman. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Washington, and he directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Gottman, and he directs the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. Okay, so to sum up here, you're saying good marriages, they're not about how you handle the big conflicts, more about day-to-day life, how you handle day-to-day life, how you handle your affection for each other, your reactions
exactly
to each other. Now, say someone has pointed out to you that you don't express fondness very clearly, even if you feel it, you're not verbally expressing it. Say that's just your character type. Is that something that you can really change in a way that's going to help your spouse feel more confident about your feelings?
One of the things that we work on that's sort of related to this is that, you know, we look at how people resolve problems. It turns out that, you know, when you select a relationship, when you select a person to be close to, you automatically are selecting a set of unresolvable, perpetual problems that you'll never resolve. And that, you know, if you married somebody else or you got into a relationship with somebody else, you'd have a different set of perpetual problems you'll never resolve. And some couples sort of establish a dialogue with these problems. And actually, it turned out when we analyzed this that about 56% of all the problems that couples had were of this kind, where they had a dialogue with problems like he was not as affectionate as she would like, or, you know, maybe he was a loner and she was very gregarious, or, you know, he was very neat and she was, you know, really untidy. This is a problem that they'll have their whole lives together. And some couples kind of come to a peace with that. It's not that they're happy about it, they have a kind of dialogue with it. It's like it's a soccer ball between them that they kick around every now and then. And there's a lot of acceptance and understanding and humor and amusement about the problem, even though they're actually trying to change it all the time, make it a little better. And that the thing you described is very much like that. And the problem becomes when you get really a lot of pain around these problems. I'll give you an example of this. You know, in this case, you get kind of a gridlock situation. And one example was a husband who wanted to spend more time with his friends. And his wife was very upset about this because what the friends did was they went to topless bars and he flirted with women. And he couldn't understand why his wife was bothered by that. And this kept being a source of tremendous pain between the two of them. So one of the things that we need to do, and we try to do in our workshops and in the therapy, is to move these gridlock conflicts that cause a great deal of pain and suffering to dialogue with perpetual problems. In other words, the problem doesn't go away. It's never going to go away. But with marriages that are working well and with longer relationships, long-term relationships, people kind of learn to accept the differences between them and live with them, even though they're still trying to change them slightly and make them better over time.
You know, you're talking about the importance of talking about your differences in the relationship. But even the threshold at which you're able and willing to talk about a difference is a difference in the relationship.
Absolutely.
I mean, often one partner really likes to talk about the relationship and work right on the relationship, and the other partner hates stuff like that.
That's right.
Hates those talks.
We even have a name for it. It's called the pursuer distancer pattern. And usually,
that's what I call it. No.
You know, one person pursues the issue and the other one tries to become distant from
right
it. Yeah.
Right.
And usually it's the woman who is the pursuer and the male who's the distancer. That's usually the situation. Although it does vary a great deal. This is characteristic of most marriages, although the problem gets accentuated when there's a lot of continued hostility in the marriage.
Well, when you're working with a couple and one person likes to talk about the relationship and the other person hates to talk about the relationship, what advice do you give the couple about how to deal with talking about the relationship?
Usually the one who wants to talk about the relationship wins. You know, it's sort of like a situation like the neater person usually wins in these conflicts about neatness. The person who has more concerns is usually the one who wins, because the important dimension is being able to respond emotionally to your partner and to have some kind of emotional connection. And what really becomes an issue is if, you know, the person who really wants to talk feels unresponded to and becomes kind of desperate in this attempt to really be understood and to really have a connection, an emotional connection with the partner. So usually the one who doesn't like to talk about it comes up a bit in their willingness to talk about it.
Well, you make an interesting distinction between a complaint and a criticism, and the way complaints and criticisms are verbalized. What are the issues there?
Well, the difference is that when you complain, you're really talking about something you're upset about, and it's not really kind of a global blaming and attack on your partner's personality. So if I say to my wife something like, you know, I'm really upset that you talked about your day during dinner and you never asked me anything about my day, that would be a complaint. But if I then add, you know, what's wrong with you? I mean, what kind of a person would do something like that? Why do you treat me this way? Then it's going to make my partner really defensive. It's kind of like I'm saying, you know, there's something wrong with her character, something wrong with her personality. And she's got to say, well, you know, I listen to you a lot of times, and sometimes you don't listen to me. And then it gets very defensive.
So what advice would you have about how to state a complaint without it escalating into criticism that leads to defensiveness and more anger?
Well, we have a thing that we teach couples to do, which we call soften startup. You know, the way they start up a complaint really matters. One of the things that's real important in this is sort of the way you say things and how you present things. Like, for example, I could, you know, let's say I've been feeling pretty distant from my wife. You know, I can say, you are so emotionally distant from me. You're emotionally unavailable, you know, and I'm fed up with it. Or I could say, you know, I've really been missing you lately. And, you know, last week when we were on the couch and we were kissing, how could we do more of that? You know, that I really miss that, you know, in our day. We're getting so stressed that we're not really doing that. So in a way, it really communicates the same thing, but But one way of presenting the complaint is pretty flattering.
Yeah.
You know, it's really saying, you know, I want more of you. You know, I really like you. I really want more of you. And the other one's saying, there's something wrong with you. So they really look for, you know, a way of saying it that softens it, makes the partner less defensive.
You started studying relationships back in the 70s, right?
Correct, right.
So you've seen the results of the women's movement over the decades.
Yes.
Do you think the women's movement has changed the relationships that you've been studying?
Absolutely. I think it's the single major thing that's happened worldwide that has affected families everywhere. And I think it's the most important change that has taken place in families. And not that it's happening everywhere, you know, and there are some places really resistant to it. But in the United States, the loss of the breadwinner role as women have entered the workforce and not only have made some money, but also have had jobs that are meaningful, has been really very big. It's really affected men in particular. And men are casting around, you know, really looking everywhere for how to be in families, how to be a good husband, how to be a good father. I think men are lost.
Do you think that you're able to use the results of your work at home? I mean, can you apply what you know scientifically to your own marriage?
I try. And my wife tries. So, yeah, we find that, you know, once we've learned something and, you know, it seems to work and make sense, that we can really use it with one another. And it's very effective. Some of the times, you know, I wish the information had been available years before. You know, we could have saved ourselves a lot of pain. But I think, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do in doing this research is to find ways of changing people, you know, helping people change their relationships that really are not that hard to do. And, you know, I think a lot of the mistake that we've made as marital therapists or people who have designed marital therapies is we've kind of tried to make people in general into psychologists. We've tried to convert them into psychologists. And really what we should do is just the opposite. Find out how everyday, you know, relationships work, how people are able to make those work, and really build a psychology from that, from learning how people manage their relationships. Because there are real masters out there at managing relationships. And there's a magic in the way they do it. You know, if you know about these little moments in which you can turn toward one another or turn away, then you kind of become aware of them and you do it, and it actually works. All of this stuff really works.
John Gottman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry. I enjoyed it.
John Gottman speaking with Terry Gross. Gottman is the director of the Seattle Marital and Family Institute. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you. Coming up, why we shop the way we do. We'll talk with shopping anthropologist Paco Underhill. Also, John Powers reviews Good Will Hunting, the new film starring Robin Williams and Matt Damon. And Kevin Whitehead reviews A Prescription for the Blues by jazz pianist Horace Silver. We're listening to it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Pianist Horace Silver hasn't settled for just trying to repeat his old successes, namely his great quintet albums of the 50s and 60s, like Song for My Father and Blowin' the Blues Away. He's branched out since then to make philosophical concept albums and records with brass sections and with singers. But jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Silver fans just want new albums that sound like the old ones, his new CD, for instance.
There are good reasons why people want Horace Silver to clone his old LPs. Classics like the Tokyo Blues and Horace Scope are so listenable, fans have played them and played them until they know every note. All they ask for is something fresh in the same vein. This time, that's just what we get. Title track from Horace Silver's CD, A Prescription for the Blues. It's on the Impulse label. For this quintet, Silver brought back a favorite drummer from the old days, Lewis Hayes. On bass is Ron Carter, who assumes a background role, which makes for a very nice rhythm section. Both of the horn players passed through Silver quintets in the 60s and 70s, Randy Brecker on trumpet and his brother Michael Brecker on tenor saxophone. Michael Brecker's saxophone sound was so familiar in the 1980s, from records and TV, it gives this set an air of temporal dislocation. It sounds a little more modern than the 50s-style material, but still like something from another time. Horace Silver's ridiculously catchy tunes are another puzzle. They have the nagging, repetitive logic of a nursery rhyme, but there's something there for adults. Like his melodies, his piano solos are built from jazz's most basic ingredients, the blues, a Latin bump, and little trails blaze through chord progressions. Horace Silver's Brother John and Brother Gene. Now, it's not like every tune on his new CD is classic. Yeah, they can't all be gems. But the music works often enough to make you wonder how Silver keeps getting away with it. How can music so upbeat and chipper not be obnoxious?
Kevin Whitehead is currently living in Amsterdam. He reviewed pianist Horace Silver's new album, A Prescription for the Blues, on the Impulse label. Coming up, what you don't know about how you shop. This is Fresh Air. The holiday shopping season is in full swing. Major stores reported disappointing revenues over Thanksgiving, so you can be sure they're competing furiously for your Christmas dollars. My guest today dissects how shoppers shop and advises stores in how they can lure you in and make you buy. Paco Underhill is a retail anthropologist and the founder and president of EnviroCell, a retail consulting firm whose clients include McDonald's, Kmart, and Hewlett-Packard. He and his colleagues have videotaped hour after hour of people shopping. What they've found is that most shoppers turn to the right when they enter a store, and most people won't notice the merchandise in the front of a store, which Underhill calls the decompression zone. And then there's the butt brush theory.
Let me explain. I'm up at a counter, I'm looking at ties. I know that in order to purchase a tie, I need 45 seconds worth of peace. If I have somebody brushing me from the rear, the chances of my having that 45 second of peace are significantly less. And therefore, I tend to come, look, and move on rather than have the time to be able to make that selection.
Now, does it just amount to that, that we don't like risking getting our derrieres brushed? Or is it a kind of an inter-animal space issue?
It's an inter-animal space, and you have to understand it's not just humans. It's generally mammals tend to be sensitive to being approached from the rear.
Do we shop by touch? Is that something that you found in your videos, that people handle sweaters and shirts the way they choose ripe fruit in supermarkets?
You know, we like to pet, and it's something we've actually tracked the number of times something has to be touched before it's bought here. We call it a product conversion ratio. And it's amazing the number of fingerprints that are on stuff on the floor of stores here. Do you know that a typical lipstick has to be handled by 8 people before it's bought? Isn't that enough to make you want to spray it with Lysol before you stick it in your purse?
Oh, that is really disturbing. And that brings me to something else that I think you might, maybe you've noticed in videos. I've seen people, and perhaps it's mostly women, circle around something they're interested in a store, like an animal circling its prey.
I think it's interesting, both that factor. The other is that sales tend to come in strings. And let's say we have a perfume display at Neiman Marcus, and there are 12 sales that happen off that display over the course of an hour. What happens is that those 12 sales all come in little strings. One person sees somebody shopping, and as soon as that person leaves, they come up because they're curious. I mean, we are an intensely curious species about what other people are seeing or doing. And that circling phenomenon is often, I like to think of it as a sort of devil and angel in somebody's head. You know, the angel is going, just, you know, listen, just take a look and walk on by. And the devil is going, ooh, let's go take a look. That looks pretty nice.
Let's talk about positioning of a store. I thought it was interesting that you found that people tend to ignore stores that are placed next to federal buildings or post offices or banks or other non-retail establishments that don't have windows, obviously, with items in them to look at, because their eye doesn't go back to perusing windows until a certain number of feet after they pass the bank or the post office. Did you figure this out also from videotape?
This is I'd been a well-documented piece of information that actually predates my days as a researcher. But the premise is simply that as somebody walks past a bank or an airline office or a dull street front window, their pace tends to speed up. And that since they aren't visually engaged with a window, once they pass that dull storefront, it takes them a little time to slow their pace back down and for their peripheral vision to expand, which is the reason why a good commercial real estate manager or a good city manager will think about the positionings of different types of businesses on a street in a way that they don't hurt each other.
How do men and women differ in how they shop?
Couple of things here. I think, first of all, let's just take the grocery store. Men seem to extract more pleasure out of the grocery store than women do. And I think most spouses will argue that when they send their husband off to the grocery store to do the family shopping, that they spend more time, they spend more money, and they get more extraneous stuff. We also know that men often, in certain product or retail categories, tend to be more buyers than shoppers. If I, as a male, walk into Victoria's Secret, I'm not there to visit a temple of sensuality. I'm there, I'm probably embarrassed, but I'm there because I have something that I'd like to buy, but I'm not quite sure what. In general, it's a good idea from the store's perspective. If you see a man walk into a lingerie section, serve him quickly and try to trade him up. He'll probably spend more money than he thought. He needs some help. He'd like to walk out the door pretty quickly and preferably take something away in a plain brown bag. Okay? If I go to the printer aisle at CompUSA, if a woman walks in, she's not there because she's just read a piece in PC Magazine, generally. She's not there to visit a temple of technology. She's there because women are the largest emerging entrepreneurial class in America. They are there because they need a technology. They're not there often with the fascination for tools. And yet the level of service that a woman gets walking into a computer store here is significantly less than a man gets. Yet they convert at a higher ratio. They are willing to listen, but they need to walk out with a product in their hands because it's something that's driven.
My guest is Paco Underhill. He's the president and founder of EnviroCell, and that's a company that offers consulting services to retail stores about how people shop. Let's talk now about the senior citizen consumer group. You say that is the biggest consumer population now that stores aren't targeting correctly, besides women, I assume. How should they target senior citizens, or how should their approach be different to attract senior citizens rather than the middle-aged or families or men or the rest of the consumer world?
I think the issue here is not just the issue of seniors. The issue is understanding that America's consumer base is aging, period, and that at 45 I don't consider myself a senior. And yet many of the same issues that seniors are concerned with increasingly affect me.
Like what?
For example, nobody is going to go broke going into the 21st century, assuming a lot of us should be wearing our reading glasses and aren't. That's theme one. Theme two is recognizing that if you're a store, that that a chair is no longer an amenity, it's a marketing tool. That if I and my significant other walk into the Limited and she has a place to comfortably plant me, she becomes a much more effective shopper because she knows I'm comfortable. I'm not going, honey, you know, can we leave now? You know, I've got nothing to do.
Let's talk about kids and shopping, and especially parents with kids trying to shop. I've noticed here in Philadelphia there's a store, IKEA, which has a place where you can park your kids for half an hour while you go and shop. And they're well, pretty well cared for, I hope. Now, I've made more ill-considered snap buys because I had to frantically fit all the shopping into just 30 minutes. It's like playing beat the clock. And it seems like a brilliant idea. I'm surprised not there aren't more stores of that size who've caught on to that.
One of the things about the changing dynamics of the American family is that as there are more families where both mother and father work, we have noticed the trend over the past 10 years that we're taking our kids to a greater variety of places. And I would argue that this is not just true at places like IKEA, but I can remember trying to get across to senior officials at a major California bank that 12% of the bodies walking in the door at a typical suburban bank are under age 7. And that if you haven't included some form of child-proofing criteria to your furniture selection, you're being foolish. But this issue of child-proofing a retail environment or thinking about children on the floor of a store is something that we as American retailers aren't always doing the best possible job. For example, in France and in Italy, many grocery stores and mass merchandisers or hypermarkets provide kid-sized shopping carts, which is, in effect, teaching the kids to become good consumers. But it also gives them something to do here. They have something, you know, to push as they move through the store. We're dealing with another problem here in the U.S. as it relates to kids, is that unlike France and Germany, we are often unwilling to leave our kids in the care of a stranger, and that as successful as IKEA is, there are many American, you know, families where the basic level of paranoia as it relates to their children is still very high.
Is it still a mystery to you what people buy and why people buy what they do or what they look for in shopping? And I'm thinking that there are all sorts of theories that are, I guess, half in jest about how shopping for us today is what hunting and gathering was for us back in prehistoric time.
Well, let's be cognizant of two things. And first, we are a social species, and that shopping has always been the opportunity that we've used since our time as hunters and gatherers simply to look at each other. And that's a lot of what drives us to the marketplace, whether we're in Papua New Guinea or at the local Newport Mall. On the other hand here, just to is that there is damn little at this point in our lives that we actually need, and that the reason we're out there in a commercial environment is to enjoy ourselves and to have a certain entertainment. And I think it's no irony as we move into the 21st century that more and more retailers are focused on our pleasure in shopping. That the rise of the Disney store or Nike Town or the new Paramount store about to open in Chicago is all focused on, you know, how can I give somebody a pleasurable experience from the moment I walk in the door.
Paco Underhill is the founder and president of EnviroCell, a retail consulting firm.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, a 54 convertible to light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Think of all the fun I've missed. Think of all the fellas that I haven't kissed. Next year I could be just as good if you check off my Christmas list. Santa baby, I want a yacht, and really that's not a lot. Been an angel all year, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Coming up, a review of the new film Good Will Hunting. This is Fresh Air. The young actor Matt Damon is suddenly everywhere. He's on the cover of Vanity Fair, in Francis Ford Coppola's The Rainmaker, and he stars in the new film Good Will Hunting, directed by Gus Van Sant. Our film critic John Powers has this review.
There's been so much recent hype about the actor Matt Damon that I expected him to be just another pretty stiff, like Matthew McConaughey or Julia Ormond. Then I saw Good Will Hunting. Damon plays Will Hunting, a cosmic genius on the order of a Mozart or Einstein. But this 20-year-old isn't your ordinary prodigy. He's an explosive street kid from the south side of Boston who works as a janitor at MIT and spends his free time carousing, sometimes violently, with his working-class buddies. His brilliance is discovered by an MIT bigshot who helps Will escape a jail term for assaulting an old enemy. This ambitious professor pushes Will toward a serious intellectual career. And by court order, he hooks him up with a shrink named Sean McGuire, who's played by Robin Williams. Although still tormented by his wife's death from cancer, McGuire takes on the task of rescuing Will from his self-destructiveness. Not only do the two become close, almost like father and son, but their relationship helps them both. The fine balance of their interaction is obvious when McGuire asks Will about his date with a Harvard student.
I went on a date last week.
How'd it go?
It was good.
Going out again?
I don't know.
Why not?
I haven't called her.
Christ, you're an amateur.
It's different from most of the girls I've been with.
So call her up, Romeo.
This girl's perfect right now. I don't want to ruin that.
Maybe you're perfect right now. Maybe you don't want to ruin that. But I think that's a super philosophy, Will. That way you can go through your entire life without ever having to really know anybody.
You ever think about getting remarried?
My wife's dead.
Hence the word remarried.
She's dead.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a super philosophy, Sean. I mean, that way you could actually go through the rest of your life without ever really knowing anybody.
Time's up.
Damon co-wrote the script with Ben Affleck, the star of Chasing Amy, who here plays Will's best pal, Chucky. The two have been real-life buddies since childhood, and their screenplay's sharpest moments come when Will is drinking and wisecracking with his homeboys. Unfortunately, as the movie progresses, these street scenes become rarer, and the story turns into another of those inspirational movies about hugging and healing. We come to see Will as a victim, not a potential Latrell Sprewell, and McGuire cures him so efficiently that therapy appears to be as easy as getting your oil changed. At one point, McGuire lectures Will about the difference between knowing something from books and knowing it from experience. You could say the same thing about Good Will Hunting, which seems to have been cobbled together from old movies like Ordinary People, Searching for Bobby Fischer, and even Rocky. Although supposedly about an intellectual titan, there's not a single idea in it. The script's morass of clichés is put across proficiently by director Gus Van Sant, who pushes all the necessary buttons. Cue the soppy music! While such empty professionalism would be acceptable from a Hollywood hack, it's depressing from Van Sant, whose first three movies, Malanoche, Drugstore Cowboy, and My Own Private Idaho, made him one of our best and most iconoclastic filmmakers. There's no scene here to approach the surreal flourishes in My Own Private Idaho, where a pin-up photo comes to life, or a house falls from the sky as a metaphor for orgasm. On the contrary, the whole movie builds to the kind of dishonest happy ending Van Sant's always despised. In fact, the only evidence that this is a Van Sant movie is his handling of Damon. Van Sant has always had a flair with young male actors, getting Matt Dillon's best ever work in Drugstore Cowboy, and a haunting turn from River Phoenix in My Own Private Idaho. Here, he discovers a sensitive Matt Damon that's wholly missing from The Rainmaker. Without ever seeming to act, Damon captures Will's many facets. His spiky pleasure in his own verbal prowess, his little boy fear that such aggressive wordplay masks, his gnawing sense of separation from enemy and friend alike, and even the radiance of his genius. No film this year has been carried so far by a single performance. Damon rises so high above his own script that each time he comes on screen, we can almost forget that Good Will Hunting is actually bad filmmaking.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Chris Fraley is our engineer today. Research assistance from Sarah Schur. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Jazz pianist Jackie Byard, who composed and performed the first Fresh Air theme, will perform tonight at the Kennedy Center as part of the Art Tatum Piano Series. We'll close today's show with this 1978 recording.